In this episode, I talk with Wayne about all things mental health, self-harm, suicide, addictions, and his work as a trauma specialist working with families and young people. The power of these conversations can't be underestimated, as they help to bring about more awareness of the causes of self-harm and trauma. Wayne is passionate about his work, and he's made it his mission to help as many people as possible, regardless of where they are in life, as mental health affects us all, whether directly or indirectly through the people we love. I hope you enjoy this episode and find it helpful. So now, over to Wayne. Hey Wayne, it's lovely to have you on my podcast, and thank you for your time, and really looking forward to this conversation because we can take it in so many different places. But let's start first of all with an introduction about yourself, who you are and how you got to where you are today.
Nice to talk to you, Sherry. I am a private practice clinician, mental health counselor in Buffalo, New York, in the U.S. And I also teach university. My career has been ever winding. At the first part of my career, I was a public school teacher in the inner city. Loved it there. It was probably one of the greatest things I've ever done in my life. I've gotten to work with and have contact with some of the most amazing students ever. And as life will happen sometimes, that part of my career sunsetted. I became an advocate for people with a rare pituitary disorder that I was diagnosed with. And I was involved with that for many, many years. Eventually, I got to a point where I had recovered from the disease. And I had my second child on the way. We were going to have two under two. And it was just time to retire from the organization because the organization was set up to never pay the CEO any money. I needed to make a living. And that was when I went back to college to get my master's in social work. And I've been doing that ever since. And I absolutely love what I do. I prefer working with a lot of moderate and moderately high risk clients. I like working with the adolescent community. I like working with GLBT issues. I work with individuals who are managing self-harming. I like to be with clients where they're at and service them how they need.
Well, that's really interesting because, I'm a family crisis coach. I didn't want to call myself a family coach because, I step in when there's a crisis.
Right.
Yeah. And help young people. So that's why I was very interested for you to come along because I think you're going to add so much value to, conversations on self-harm, the LGBTQ, plus community, the struggles that they have, and also that they are significantly at risk, more at risk of self-harm and suicide as well as a group, addictions. I mean, for me, that's all, forms of self-harm.
I find it to be an honor to be the person who gets reached out to when someone is in trouble. It's a sign of trust. It is a sign of belief. And I like being the person who they, who they can come to and say, help me, please. I don't know where I'm going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's the most recent case that you've had to deal with without obviously disclosing any names or any identifiable?
Literally 1 hour ago.
What happened
And
an
this
hour
is
ago?
a client who I've been working with for several years, and they've been managing for a while. And in the course of our conversation, it was disclosed to me that they had had this incident where they the pressures of, as you know, the holiday season can, for a lot of people, is really a challenging time.
Yeah, it's difficult.
And for this particular client, the challenge of the holiday season became too much. And we had a really, really heartfelt conversation about this. The thing that I really took as personally validating of our relationship was when they said to me that they were telling me things that they haven't even told their diary yet. So that's, I mean, I don't know how you could ask for a greater vote of confidence.
It's so
And that's,
true.
that's why we're here. We're here working with people in crisis, and we're where the rubber meets the road.
So, was that client suicidal or
No,
no?
I don't think that everyone who harms has suicidality. Has this person struggled with suicidality in the past? Yes. However, that is not the case for right now. And I think part of what we do, part of what we manage, part of what our obligations are is to be able to distinguish how high risk the behavior is. Yeah, is this someone who genuinely is a danger to themselves or others? Is this someone who's really just having a horrible day and maybe didn't make the best choice and is mentally and emotionally available to coping skills, is available to discuss ways to manage their emotions that they had at this brief point of time?
I think
And
that's a big question, and I think the biggest fear for parents when I speak
yes.
to them is, first of all, the shock of self-harm itself and all the connotations that that brings with it. And then obviously, will that now lead to, my child taking their own life? Because when you're unfamiliar with cutting as a form of self-harm, okay, rather than for me, alcohol abuse, drug addiction, eating disorders, sexual promiscuity. That's quite a violent act, isn't it? And I think it's natural for the mind to go to that end point. And so I think it's an important message to say that it doesn't always, the majority then, let's say, of young people who self-harm have no intentions of taking their own lives.
Right. I would say I find it interesting that you use the word violent, because I believe there's violence in any form of intentional self-harm. It's that certain forms of self-harm are seen as socially unacceptable. And whereas if you've got a young person who is sexually promiscuous, they may be seen as making poor life choices, or maybe being a cad, or being someone who is vaunted within their circles, but they're still trying to fill a sadness through some sort of coping skill that might be putting themselves in real harm. So my conversation with people is, what is the function of the behavior? And to be honest with you, if I'm working with an adolescent who is engaging in self-harm, it's not a guarantee that the parents are going to be the first people to know.
No.
I'm going to, because for me to tell the parents is for me to breach that individual's trust. And if this individual is engaging in self-harm that is low risk, low level, I'm likely going to try to work with them more directly for as long as possible before I have to get parental involvement. Because quite honestly, the second that I start telling any secrets to their parents, or their guardians, or whoever the adult in their lives are, the quicker I have to work to get any information. I believe that the most important part of mental health counseling is building a meaningful relationship.
Yeah.
And without that, you have nothing. So I'll tell the parents, I'm going to work with your child. I'm going to really focus on building the connection. I've had parents over my career who will scold me after session when we're walking back and saying, are you really doing any work? I just heard you guys laughing all the time, and you're walking out with my child and they're laughing. Therapy shouldn't be fun.
Oh, gosh.
Well, I mean, no, therapy isn't fun, but it should be enjoyable on some level.
It shouldn't
level.
Be torturous either, though, should it?
Right. So my number one responsibility is for your child to have trust in me, have faith in me as their advocate. And sometimes we'll joke, and sometimes it will be ridiculous jokes that have nothing whatsoever to do with the topic of discussion of self-harm. Because if they want to talk about their friend at lunch today, that's still part of building the trust circle in order for them to discuss. Last night after dinner, my father yelled at me. I went upstairs to my room and I did A, B, and C to manage that pain. Yeah. So we'll laugh about the person's friend who did something ridiculous at lunch, because that's how I'm going to get to the information I need to get to.
Exactly. What I have discovered is that you do need a different approach when you're coaching or counseling adults to children and or young people. And young people, it's more so than with adults about building that trust, because I think they've just got, unfortunately, just the way that the world is, a natural suspicion towards adults, isn't it? Like, yeah, heard it all before. Yeah, you're trying to hang with the kids and be hip, and I'm not going to buy any of that. So there's already that resistance in
you're them. Just another authority figure.
Exactly. And the sign that parents do need to be aware of is when they're laughing with you, wow, that's a breakthrough.
Yes.
That's a cause for celebration, because they've accepted you at some level where they've let their guards down. Because, you know, you try to laugh, you can't just laugh for the sake of it.
Yeah, if you're laughing, even if Even if it's a fake laugh, even if it's a forced laugh, if you do it long enough, your biochemistry will begin to lean into the happiness that's involved with laughter. One of my favorite assignments that I give to new adolescent clients is I want you to come up with a playlist for me. Used to be a mixtape, now it's a playlist.
Yeah. How times have changed.
Yes. How do I get to know you through music? Because
that's a good one.
These teens have headphones all the time. And for them to sit and tell me everything in the world about them as an individual, number one, is going to be extremely challenging. Number two, we don't have that kind of time in one or two sessions. Mm-hmm. And number three, it's really not enjoyable for the child. If they can say, if they have this assignment of build me a playlist that I can get to know you, that's something they enjoy. That's something that's intimate. It's something that's personal. And they can identify that this person wants to get to know me more directly. Yes, I may still be seen as an authority figure, not entirely worth trusting. But here's some music that I like. And I will go through the list with them in the subsequent session. And my favorite thing is when there's something on the list that I recognize and I like.
Because and there, you've got your automatic connection.
Right. Right. And if there's a genre that they lean towards, I can be like, oh, I really like, you know, this song by AC/DC. Have you ever heard Metallica? Yeah. And surprising number of adolescents are listening to 80s and 90s hard rock.
Yeah.
And that's fantastic for bonding because I, you know, we can talk about all these different things that I do understand. And then in next session, I will come back and say, you know what? I listened to this song and this song and this song, and I really liked A, B, and C about it. Mm. Can you tell me why these songs represent who you are as a person?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what story do they tell? Right. Yeah, very, very clever. And that's it, isn't it? It's speaking to them at their level, reaching to them and being, you've got to be adaptive. You've got to be creative. You can't right. just, do you know what I mean? Come away with a counseling degree. And then the textbook says that I should ask this question in this fashion. And they're just sitting there staring at you like you've gone mad.
Well, and that's the thing is, are there people who graduated college with me who are like scholarly in specific therapeutic interventions that I am not? Yes. And will I connect with the client before you? 100% of the time.
Yeah.
You know, we just, in the US, we just celebrated Thanksgiving. And one of the things, when I'm talking with younger therapists or I'm talking with students in social work, one of the things that I always encourage them to do is have the modalities of therapy that they enjoy and know the other ones too comfortably. And that is because, and I used this example the other day, I asked the classroom of people, how many of you cooked some part of your Thanksgiving? And about half the room raised their hand. I was one of them. I said, how many of you cooked with only one spice for the meal you made? And they looked at me like I was crazy. So I asked, why do you cook with more than one spice? One spice should be fine. And they're like, it doesn't make it delicious. It doesn't make it complex enough to enjoy the meal. Exactly. That's why you have to know more than one modality of therapy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there is an art in generally connecting with people, and you know, like we've identified, it's different working with young people, and I love the way they see the world and how switched on they are, which I don't think as adults we give them enough credit for.
I think young people today are far wiser than we can ever imagine. Here in the US, we're going through a kind of employee union revolution where these unions are growing stronger and stronger far quicker than they ever have in my lifetime, not since the 1940s or 50s. And I really credit it, if you want to look for the roots, believe it or not, back to my hometown, because the first Starbucks shop that voted to unionize was in my hometown.
Oh.
And okay. It was a bunch of 20 to 25 year olds who were tired of the Starbucks mass oppression system in service of giving people their addiction of choice.
Yeah.
And so they voted to unionize, and Starbucks screwed up by making it far more of a news
event. Yeah, worthy item. Yeah, absolutely.
So then other Starbucks
stores put them in a good light, did it?
Other Starbucks stores said, we want what they have. And then other shops were like, well, you know, we should form a union too, because our owners keep promising us that if we don't form a union, we're going to get this, this, and this. But it's not happening over all these years of my working here. We should, and it just kept growing and growing in momentum. And now you've got the auto manufacturers who have gotten this far stronger union contract, and school district just got a much stronger union contract, the entertainment industry. And the unions are undergoing this revolution that started with some 20-year-olds who didn't listen to our generation tell them they can't do that.
Yeah, or it's okay the way it is. I mean, that's it. They're definitely here to agitate and rock the boat and question why. Whereas we just went along, and whether we agreed or not, we just kind of, oh, okay, I guess that's just how it is. Whereas they're going, God, no, absolutely not.
And somehow it's become socially unacceptable for them to advocate for more than we accepted. Now, my generation has accepted this mantle of passively disinterested. And I'm not sure if it's because we were latchkey kids, but we were taught active ambivalence. Like, okay, whatever the system is, you know, just do your work and go home and whatever about it.
Mm-hmm.
And the younger generation is saying, no, I deserve more. And I support them in that. I think that they're going to make the upcoming generations bring the balance of pay between the workers and the employers far more in balance than it is today for our generation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I applaud them, and they're paving the way for all of us.
Yep.
You know, doing what we, for whatever reasons, didn't have the courage maybe to do, and there's a lot of self-belief, I think, in that too. So whereas they like to say sort of like quite dismissively, you know, they're like the snowflake generation.
Yes.
And they're not resilient and they moan and they complain. But they're getting stuff done. They're making those changes, aren't they? Or demanding.
They're demanding the
those changes.
And they're getting them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I always kind of push back on that whole snowflake generation thing, because why is it that it is socially acceptable to deride someone for advocating for what they deserve?
Yeah.
And maybe that's because of the nature of the work that I do.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, you know, it just gives you a totally different viewpoint and perspective on things, isn't it? And that's why I think, you know, working with young people is just so enriching.
Yeah, it's exciting. It's enjoyable. It's, and my young people who do need that extra help, my young people who are struggling with strong emotions are also my young people who are leading the way. They just need help in certain areas, which don't we all? I think one of the greatest things about the 21st century is we've begun to normalize the idea of mental health care, where it's not one of those things that takes place behind closed doors, where it's not, I heard they have a therapist.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Untouchable.
I have clients who joke with me about how they regularly talk about what we discuss in therapy sessions at their lunch table. That is not the world I grew up in.
No, absolutely not. Unimaginable.
And it's that kind of freedom that, I mean, I celebrate that. That is a level of freedom that I could never conceive of.
Yeah. Taking that shame element away. Yeah, and it's okay. Yeah. However, we can't deny that the world has changed since COVID.
That's true.
And unfortunately, it is the younger generation that have suffered the impact of that more adversely than any other group.
I have three children, and one is in fifth grade, one is in fourth grade, one is in first grade. And so seeing how COVID has impacted each of their learnings is phenomenally interesting. Because the first grader shrugged it off. It barely touched him. I think maybe lost a handful of days in pre-K and whatnot, but it wasn't academically detrimental. But the fourth and fifth grader, they lost their kindergarten, first grade, second grade years. And that, they're starting to get caught up with where they probably should be had COVID never happened.
Yeah.
But a year and a half is a long time.
It is. And in the life of a young person, 6 months is a year.
Mm-hmm. And then you factor in, not only for the academics, which obviously is very important, but I think it also delayed a lot of children's social emotional development.
That's the biggest thing. I'm not really that interested in the academic side of it.
Right.
It's the social skills and emotionally how that's impacted them, and that we're probably not going to realize the sheer depth and vastness of this for another 5 years, maybe, when it all properly manifests.
I mean, the research is already bubbling up, and I appreciate reading those articles because I like seeing what current information is saying. But I think you're right that to really meaningfully study how individuals were impacted, or how the generation was impacted in a broad sense, we're going to be learning for many. And COVID, we like to talk about the COVID era, pretending that COVID's gone away. But you and I both know it hasn't. There's been a great uptick in COVID cases again. I know I've had, over the past month, more than half a dozen clients who had to switch to telehealth because of a COVID diagnosis in their home. I've had students who couldn't come to class due to a COVID diagnosis. It's still there. We just like... If we close our eyes and pretend real hard, we can pretend it's not there.
Yeah, I mean, there's other aspects of it. There's the vaccinate, the injured through the vaccine. There's the long COVID. So, yep. I mean, you know, then we're talking decades, aren't we?
Let's be honest, we're not going to know what the effect of having COVID has on our bodies for decades. We're not going to know what the effect of a new vaccination is going to have on our bodies until decades from now. Most of COVID, we don't know yet.
Yeah.
And it's impossible to know. And, you know, everyone can stake out their sides. But at the end of the day, we need to get a generation removed before we can realistically look at it and say this was the impact.
Yeah. But there's a huge danger in this generation growing up in that fear.
Yeah.
And how that impacts their mental health, how the self-talk leads to, well, what's the point?
I think
not seeing a bright, rosy future ahead of them.
I was reading an article yesterday, and this is more US politics than UK politics, but really arguing that Social Security, again, they're forecasting a more specific end date for when it reaches insolvency. And I think right now they're estimating, according to the article I read the other day, about 10 years out, which, if that is accurate, is right on par with what the experts were saying back in the 1980s. And the way you described the way the younger generation is growing up with a certain level of dismissiveness, that was kind of how my generation grew up thinking about Social Security. That, I mean, we can try and fight for it, but we know that when we go to the mailbox, there's not going to be a check for us.
No.
And 10 years from now is pretty close to when I'm going to be going to the mailbox looking for my check. So I think, I don't know, I think every generation has their burden assigned to them by the previous generation. And the upcoming generation's burden is going to be COVID and its effects. I think the effect of COVID on social emotional development, it's, for some people, they will walk through it like it never happened. For the vast majority, it will delay them a little bit, but they'll muddle through and they'll find new paths. They'll channel new directions. I think that COVID did offer some positive pathways for mental health, and that I can now work with anyone so long as I have an internet connection.
Yeah.
So yeah. I think that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. Then in that last 10 to 20% of youth impacted by COVID, I think the mental health results are going to be excruciating. And that's the section that I most worry about, because they do have they continue to struggle with face-to-face contact. They continue to have trust issues with authority figures. There are so many barriers to them accepting help from perceived authority figures. That's where we really, I think, as mental health professionals, we need to be training our focus on is how do we help those individuals before they are not willing to accept the services.
Yeah,
exactly. The signs are there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, it's 75% of all mental health illnesses manifest themselves by the age of 14. So, I mean, you know, we do need to start younger, and we need to look at more preventative measures. We need to give the schools more support with mental health.
I also think we need to be spending more money on mental health care in our schools than we do on our athletic teams. You know, exactly. I live in a city where the local professional football franchise was just gifted $1 billion with a B. And with the new stadium, they're going to raise prices to astronomical rates, and there's only so much in the pie. So where is that $1 billion coming from? How many schools are going to be lacking in mental health care? How many schools are going to have school social workers with one worker to 300 kids?
Yeah. That's where we need to refocus, don't we? Where all of that support goes, because as the landscape changes, so we need to also adapt. And for me, it goes without saying, the young people are our future.
Yes.
They're the future generation. So, I mean, it just seems madness to not be putting an awful lot of investment and attention there in the young people, particularly now post-COVID, when we've seen the numbers triple.
It's the isolation that is really the worst part.
Yeah.
It was normalized. And I think a lot of self-harm did significantly increase during those early 2020, 21 years.
Absolutely. Absolutely, because it's a coping mechanism, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I mean, not the best coping strategy, but it is.
And that was the adolescent version of mom hiding in the pantry closet with a bottle.
Exactly.
I remember being astounded when everything shut down except for essential services that included grocery stores and liquor stores.
Yeah. Makes you wonder, doesn't it?
Why is a liquor store an essential service other than the liquor lobby has enough money to convince the legislature to make them an essential service?
Mm. Yeah. But I mean, domestic abuse also went up.
Absolutely. And that is not at all unrelated to the amount of alcohol being sold.
Exactly. Exactly. So.
And, you know, I worry about the parents who target their kids' self-harm, because that's something that they can reach without having to focus on their need for mental health care. I think everyone benefits from mental health care. I believe everyone benefits from the ability to have a conversation with someone who's not emotionally invested with them.
We absolutely. I mean, you know, why do we turn to friends and offload on them? Why do we feel so good when we've had a talk and we feel like we can get through the day now because we've, right. you know, gotten some great advice or seen things from a different perspective? And I always say that mental health is no different to physical health or eating well, you know, right. looking after your body. It's all part and parcel. And if someone says, oh, I've never had a mental health issue, then, you know, you've never been nervous at exams, felt so sick the morning before, or that awful feeling that you know, I remember having when you've got this awful job and it's Sunday night and you're thinking, oh God, and tomorrow's Monday.
Yes.
And that's it, you know? But do you feel that parents understand self-harm?
I don't think they have a clue, by and large. I think parents get most upset about self-harm because they make it more about themselves and they make it a moral failing of their own rather than talking with their child and saying, what's going on? How do I help?
Mm-hmm.
And it's really not more complicated than that. It's, you're struggling. I love you. What can I do to help? And usually that involves bringing in someone who is not emotionally involved with the home.
Yeah.
Yeah, if your child comes to me, I don't look at their self-harming as a moral failure. I, number one, want to keep them safe. Number two, want to figure out why they're self-harming. What function does it serve, as I said earlier? And what are some beginning interventions we can use to substitute this coping's behavior with a different, more safe coping behavior.
Yeah.
And it's really just, you know, it's putting one thing in for another. It's teaching someone about breathing in order to relax. It's helping them discover when it's Sunday afternoon and I find my heart racing and I really hope Joe isn't in on Monday because Joe always makes my life harder. Working with them to identify, I have no control whether or not Joe comes to work on Monday. And this is how I'm going to advocate for me, so that way I'm not carrying Joe inside me on my day off.
Mm-hmm.
And when parents can begin to identify that they can have control over their spiraling anxiety, hopefully their child's spiraling anxiety is less of a moral failing, less of a something that needs to be overcorrected, just something that needs to be talked about. There, you know, what's the line? There's no disinfectant like sunlight.
Mm.
Yeah, and bringing light to an issue, bringing light to a difficult issue makes it easier for the entire family to manage. And if you're not carrying the secret inside of you, if you're not carrying a backpack filled with boulders, it becomes more manageable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very true. But I think the first step and the most difficult first step I find for parents is actually having that conversation.
Agreed. Agreed. And for parents to have that conversation, it needs to be one where they can make themselves emotionally available. And not hold it as a judgment of themselves. Just, my child needs to talk and I need to be emotionally available.
Exactly. And take me and my ego out of the equation.
Right. And we as parents, we have to have difficult conversations. We talk with our kids about sex. We talk to them about drugs. We talk to them about friends who are not safe to be with. We talk to them about the person who they wanted to ask out and said no, and how sad they are about that. Why can't we have a conversation with them about how they're managing their sadness?
Because they haven't been educated in that.
Right.
That's the biggest thing. So as much as I love working with young people, I find that it's only a part of the equation, because if the parents aren't educated on how to actually deal with, how to manage what's going on in the home, because at the end of the day, that's where the whole of the focus is, isn't it?
Right.
Then whatever great work you're doing and achieving with that young person falls flat the minute they walk through that door. And the parents are clueless, say the wrong thing, or make it all about themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think that's the biggest obstacle, is decoupling the parents' pride from the event.
Yeah.
And it's, while the parent is not the client, they're kind of the secondary client, in that we need to, those first few minutes before session starts, the last few minutes after session ends, giving them reassurance that, hey, you're there, you're helping, you're bringing your child to therapy, and I appreciate you for that.
Yeah.
You're doing what you can to help your child, and I celebrate that for you. And I know that dealing with all this is extraordinarily uncomfortable, and I encourage you to continue to do it. And if there's a time where you do want to have a conversation where it's you, the child, and myself, we can figure out a way to make that happen if we're working on what a better tomorrow looks like. Because the parents can be a partner if they're brought into the fold in the right way. And I think parents, the way to help a child with self-harm is to develop a partnership with the parents rather than a rivalry.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That doesn't help anyone.
And sometimes there are going to be times where the adolescent comes into session where the parent is the enemy. And that's okay. And we'll have those conversations and we'll talk through it and we'll figure out ways in which to see that maybe mom or dad didn't make the best decision in this moment, or maybe stepfather said something that he didn't actually know was going to be offensive, even though you feel like they should have known.
Yeah.
And how do we work with that? So, yeah. The more we can talk, the more we can openly communicate, I think the better it is for everyone in the household.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you said, shine a light in all of those dark corners, isn't it?
Right.
And have those uncomfortable conversations. So be comfortable with being uncomfortable, because the end goal that you ultimately want to achieve is worth every bit of that pain.
Right. Absolutely, 100%.
Yeah. So, Wayne, it has been an amazing conversation with you. I've really enjoyed this. And I think that, you know, you've helped a lot. I think you know, given a lot of guidance and lots of different perspectives. So
I appreciate that.
Yeah, no,
this has been a very enjoyable conversation, Sheree. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Like we said, these conversations need to be had.
The more the conversations happen, the more everyone succeeds.
Yeah. So before we go, where can people find out more about you, connect with you, or even contact you to work with you?
Yeah, you can contact me. I'm at willowgrovecounseling.net, or they can contact me by telephone, 716, country code 1, area code 716-225-4789. I can be called or texted at that phone number. And yeah, I'm more than happy to work with individuals. I do work with organizations, with schools. I like to give voice with solution-focused strategies on how to manage the conversations that people are afraid to have.
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you so much, Wayne.
Thank you.
You know, good luck with everything that you're doing.
And you as well. I look forward to hearing more from you.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you agree that this episode was really interesting. We covered a lot of topics, and I think my biggest takeaway would be showing parents how to separate their personal feelings from what's going on with their child so that they can talk to them about their mental health struggles and provide the best possible support. Let me know your thoughts. Leave a comment below. And if this episode has resonated with you and you'd like to reach out for a chat, or you have a story you'd like to share, then DM me or send me an email at shari@sharilewisonfrisch.com. Thank you, and until the next episode, take care.